We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. There was a time when we humans thought that we were at the center of the universe, that even the sun revolved around us. Now, today, of course, we know that is not the case, but we are only beginning to understand the inner workings of the star that makes life on Earth possible. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be getting the story of our neighborhood star. We'll try to appreciate its importance to world culture and perhaps review some of the current solar science. And our guest for the show will be Richard Cohen. He is the author of a newly published book that is titled Chasing the Sun, the Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. It's published by Random House, and it is the result of a number of years of work that he did looking at a number of things, at how it is that people have thought about the sun over time, going back to the ancient world, how different cultures have thought about it, also talking about its significance to life on Earth, what it is that scientists who study the sun know about it, what it is that we have yet to know. And he has put all of that into the book, which he subtitles The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. Richard Cohen is former publishing director of Hutchinson and also of Hodder and Stoughton. He's founder of Richard Cohen Books. He's the author of another book that is a history of sword fighting. It is titled By the Sword, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send along your comments by email, you may do that too. And that is, the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you want to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome to do that. And Mr. Cohen, hello.
Hello, and good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. You know, over time, I guess I have heard various authors talk about writing the book that they wanted to read, and I think that this is the case with you. In fact, going back to the time that you were in the publishing business, you apparently were looking for someone to write this book, and it seemed that it came down to your having to write it yourself.
Well, I went to the New York Public Library, close to where I live, and there are nearly 6,000 books under the entry for Sun, but none of them really did quite what I was looking for. And your introduction kindly referred to the science covered in the book. That's probably only about 30% of what I put in there, because the sun really gets into everything, as I learned.
It's certainly the case that without the sun there would be no life on Earth. And it must be that people going back a long way understood just how important it was, or maybe it's just they didn't like being out in the dark. In any case, that many people over time have worshipped it as a god. Interestingly enough, though, as you point out, that people's feelings about the sun, well, I was about to say ran hot and cold. I guess I just did. That is that they recognized how important it was and how beneficial it was, but also it was something that they felt had to be tamed.
It's very odd, interesting too, but odd that there's always been a mixture of emotions over the sun. Mm-hmm. And as you say, it's always been part of humankind's response to know how powerful the sun is, and people are pretty obviously aware of the light it gives us and the heat it gives us, quite beyond the fact of life itself. But we've wanted to control it in many ways. One of the people I read, Carl Jung, was interviewing people in Central America in the 1920s, and there was one particular tribe he was talking to where a tribe elder said, well, you know, we have to keep an eye on the sun, because if we don't look after it, it may not appear the next day. Mm. And that's a very strong feeling throughout a whole range of cultures, that it's a reciprocal thing. The sun gives us life, but we've got to do our bit to control and look after it too.
Yeah. And of course, perhaps this depends on where it is that you live, but people do recognize that the sun has killing force, and that in a very literal way, it has the potential to scorch the earth.
In some parts of the world, yeah, I mean, you're quite right. The sun is worshipped, but not to the same extent as elsewhere. And in Africa, where it's very much, you know, the star that destroys and parches and so on, the sun is seen as rather a lesser deity behind, well, water and earth are both more highly valued.
I suppose it's natural to assume that, particularly once people got to the point where they could manipulate fire, they understood that fire was a source of light, it was a source of warmth. Was it then sort of automatic that they would think that what the sun was some kind of fire, that is, it was burning, and it was in the sky? They didn't exactly know where and know how far away, but that they made the connection between a kind of fire that they could touch or get close to and what was going on with the sun.
It's been a very odd relationship, of course, until really Copernicus in the 15th century. You had the idea that the sun was going around the earth and the earth was the center of the universe in every sense. But after the Copernican revolution and Galilei acting as Copernicus's kind of PR man, really, in putting his view for general consumption, there's been a series of ways in which the sun has been diminished. And I think maybe the most interesting example of that is, as you say, over the fire issue, that in the mid-19th century, one of the great burning issues, and I'm sorry, it's very difficult, puns are intentional or unintentional, they come in streams. The great burning issue is, where does the sun get its energy? Mm-hmm. Because the 19th century saw a revolution, really, in people's awareness of how old the earth was, how old, therefore, the sun was, the universe itself was. And people realized that if the sun was, as they saw it, at least 6 million years old, they still didn't have that accurate a view of the length of the universe, then it couldn't be burning up matter because it would have burnt itself out. So where did its energy come from? And when in the 20s and 30s you had a whole range of amazing scientific revelations, the splitting of the atom and then the discovery of nuclear fusion, and it led, of course, to the hydrogen bomb, exploded at the beginning of the 50s, suddenly human beings were able to reproduce the sun's energy, nuclear fusion, on Earth. And that, again, led really to a demoting of the sun. We could do what the sun could do.
Did people in the past, I wonder how they actually, back at the time when people were still thinking perhaps of the sun as just another kind of fire, they would have had experience with fire, and certainly they would know that if you didn't continue to toss fuel into it, something that would burn, the fire would go out. How did they think about that?
Well, they had, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, they produced a series of extraordinary scientists, but they also had some pretty odd ideas. You know, the earth is a spinning plate, the sun is no larger than a shield. In Pythagoras' day, his followers believed that the sun wasn't even the source of the heat that heated the earth, but was a giant reflector, and there was some other force that was producing the great energy, which the sun just acted really as no more than a mirror for. So you've got extraordinarily right ideas. One Greek astronomer worked out that the sun wasn't going down around the earth, but the other way round. Hundreds of years before Copernicus, but you've also got these odd ideas about celestial fires.
How did that one man who said, contrary to what everybody else was saying, who said actually he thought that the Earth was going around the sun, not the other way around, how were his ideas received?
Well, that was a Greek called Aristarchus, who was one of the leading astronomers of his day. But it was a mixture of things. First of all, obviously, communication wasn't that easy in the ancient world. There were no newspapers, and your own programs, I believe, wasn't running then. He wasn't based in Athens itself, but some hundreds of miles away. So there was only a limited exposure for his ideas. But those who did hear about it weren't at all pleased. They pretty well ostracized him, and they also ridiculed him. They said, well, if the Earth was really going round the sun, why don't we leave the birds behind? Why don't we keep on falling off the Earth? What's keeping us from with our feet on the ground? Obviously, the Earth is stationary. You've only got to look about you and see that common sense tells you that.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Richard Cohen, and he is the author of a new book that is titled Chasing the Sun, The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. It's published by Random House, and it is about the sun and its place in human culture and human history, also science. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about how it is in so many cultures, people recognize the importance of the sun, that they made it into a deity or the kind of representation of a deity. And while whether or not that was the top god in the pantheon, it certainly was very important. And scholars then have looked at that and have asked some questions about, well, is there something universal about that? How far back does it go? And I was really interested to learn about this man, Friedrich Müller, who actually made the argument, and one time this was apparently very persuasive, and he was quite prominent in his time. He made this argument that the sun was actually at the root of everything, of culture, of language, of everything.
Well, Max Müller sounds like a Comedy Central name, but he was an extraordinary person, as you say, in his day, was very well known. He was as famous as Darwin in the mid to late 19th century. And he was a German who came over to Britain to do further research in his main subject, which was Sanskrit. And he ended up with 3 Oxford University professorships. He's extraordinary in that way. And he wrote a book saying, look, I know from Sanskrit this is the language which is the basis for all Western European languages. And that language is itself based on solar imagery. And the first images, the first metaphors, which humankind, when they were discovering language, were based on the sun. It's a fairly obvious thing to do. And his writings really extend that idea. And a lot of it is very convincing. He went too far. Not all languages are based on Sanskrit, fairly obviously. And language is indeed more complicated than just building on the sun, however many language ideas and metaphors we get from that. So that's, I think, why he's not an everyday name. But in his time, he showed that a lot of our language is sun-based.
You've traveled around and gone to a number of places and had some great sun-related experiences. And I think perhaps if one can think of beautiful, powerful, awesome sunrises or sunsets one has seen, depending on where you get the chance to be. The first story in the book that you tell, in fact, is climbing Mount Fuji in Japan to see the sunrise.
I was lucky enough and got a special grant from the Sloan Foundation here in New York to go in all, I think it's now to 20 countries researching this book. And I thought, well, I ought to begin the book with a dawn and end with a sunrise, but which sunrise and which dawn? Mm-hmm. And I was in Japan, not particularly, but it happened to be in mid-June 5 years ago, and a friend of mine said, well, you ought to climb Mount Fuji. So it was actually out of season, but I got permission to go up, but I was on my own. And I decided that if I went up on the afternoon and night of the 20th of June, if I made decent enough progress, I'd get to the top of the mountain in time for 4:37 in the morning, and I would see the sunrise on Japan's most sacred mountain on Midsummer Day, the summer solstice. Mm. And I actually got to the top after various adventures, because I lost my way, and I suffered from altitude sickness and various other things, which I wouldn't advise other people to suffer from. And I reached the top of the mountain to find that I was totally on my own, watching the sunrise.
And how was, would, I'm gathering that that was a profound kind of experience.
It was. I mean, I'm not a believer in Shintoism or any Japanese religion, and I'm not a pantheist thinking marvelous things about the sun. But when you see, if you can imagine being 13,000 feet up, the mountaintop covered with snow, on your own on this special day, and just seeing the sun arise. You know, we say something dawns on us, and that's what it was like, a sudden realization of how wonderful the sun can seem.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone in Normal, not that far from us, on our line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Sir?
Oh, I had to come across some information in the mythology. I'm not really too familiar with it all. I need to read more of that. But the importance of the sun being thrown into a religion or whatever, and that actually historically the worship of the sun involved the celebration of the birthday on December 25th, because that's when it emerges out of death on the calendar, because that's the shortest time of the year. But then now, once again, the light reemerges. And there's also something about maybe that there is a relation, because there is a constellation called the Southern Cross, which can be seen in the sky about that time. I thought that was interesting, and then that there is the story, if you go into, because there's a personification with the figure, perhaps, where it travels and has mingled amongst man and has stories and adventures and a tribe of followers and whatnot. I wonder if you could comment on that. Thank you.
All right.
No, you're absolutely right. And when Christendom came in, when Constantine became really the ruler of Rome and the nearby states, and was himself baptized as a Christian, he made Christianity the state religion. And at that time, the great pagan festivals, as you say, were built around the sun, and the winter solstice, the dates varied a bit, but it's normally thought to be the 21st of December. And in the 4th century AD, the papacy decided that it would make an actual date for Christ's nativity. He was probably born in the spring, not in December at all. But it made obvious sense to them, really, to kind of sweep up all the pagan solar festivals and convert them, along with people, to Christianity. And that's why you get the winter solstice and Christmas Day becoming, in effect, the same celebration.
Hmm. In those places where there are dramatic seasons, certainly you would expect that people would have strong feelings about the fact, or at least would understand the fact, that there are times, there are the light times and the dark times, the warm times and the cold times, the times when things are growing and when they're not. And so it would be important to keep track of all of those things. And so there are a lot of places where they have festivals that line up with high summer or with midsummer and also midwinter, that point where the days get shorter and shorter and shorter until the things turn again, and then they start getting longer, and you start thinking that, yes, one day it will be spring. Is that something of a universal, marking those particular times?
Very much so. I mean, to go back to a question you were raising about fires, one of the interesting facts about solar celebrations is you both in the summer solstice and the winter solstice, you get people celebrating those days with fires. You had midsummer fires, and you had midwinter fires. You had great wheels, the Viking term Yule, which we think of as Yuletide, is based on similar derivations of the word wheel. You had wheels made out of wheat or vegetation rolled from the top of hills and put on fire as a human version of the sun in its crossing. And you had, it's no surprise that people saw the time of winter solstice as the shortest day of the year, and they look forward to the light returning. Light is so important to us, not just because we can see by it and do everything else, but just psychologically it's so vital to us that burning great fires had a tremendous spiritual importance through the ages.
Let's talk again with another caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. You're talking about myths. May I suggest that we have not yet emerged from the age of myths? In the history of science, as recently as the early 1900s, scientists thought the universe was eternal, and that myth was so strong that when Einstein's relativity equations, he developed his relativity equations, and they indicated that the universe had a beginning. And Einstein artificially inserted a constant into his equations to keep the universe from having a beginning, because he thought the scientific community wouldn't believe that the universe had a beginning. By the way, the reason they didn't want the universe to have a beginning was because that would indicate it had to be created. That would indicate there was a God. There was a philosopher by the name of Schleiermacher. He was a German. He said, "We have progressed to the place where we no longer need the God factor." So they descended into myths.
No, you're quite right. Another great, this time French, astronomer called Laplace was asked by Napoleon about what all his scientific discoveries were leading him to. And he simply turned around and told his emperor, "I have no need for God in my universe." But what you say is absolutely right. And, you know, I think it was only last week there was a news item saying scientists are astonished there are millions and millions more stars in the universe than ever they had calculated. So science is constantly on the move and having to readjust what it felt was the nature of reality.
How old is the sun?
Well, if you take the universe as being around, this is very rough, 14 billion years old, I suppose the sun is about 6 billion. Mm-hmm. We've got about 5.6 billion years left of the sun, in case you're worried.
So the sun is at middle age, roughly speaking.
Roughly middle age. Incidentally, on the question of myths, your last caller was quite right that they continue. They don't just continue in science. In the Asian subcontinent, in India, for instance, there are all kinds of myths, particularly relating to eclipses. It's still believed in various parts of rural India that if a pregnant woman goes outside during a period of an eclipse, her child might be born deaf or blind or with a cleft palate. And women will have a mixture of ghee, which is kind of clarified butter, and cow dung, which is meant to have protective properties, put on their bellies as a protection against any evil that an eclipse might bring.
Yeah. I was interested to learn that we have talked about the fact that certainly people, ancient peoples, worshipped the sun or connected it with deities, and so maybe not surprising, over time, many supreme rulers have claimed that they were descended from the sun. What's interesting to me is that in modern times, a lot of people, supreme rulers, have connected with it as well, perhaps not quite in the same way, not claiming that they were descendants of the sun god, but have certainly tried to use the sun as something that bolstered their authority or right to rule.
Well, exactly so. You know, we tend to laugh at somebody like Louis XIV calling himself the Sun King, but of course he was extremely useful in his politics to ally himself to such a great power. And we also laugh at the fact that in ancient times, there's a kind of, if you put a kind of belt around an atlas of the world, you get a whole section of the globe where people call themselves children of the sun, believing themselves to be really the sun's progeny, to be divine beings themselves. But it's not really a laughing matter in terms of us being any wiser than the ancients, because in recent times, you've got somebody like, well, Chairman Mao, even before the Cultural Revolution, he would describe himself in images as looking like the sun. The very cover of the Little Red Book, which sold so many millions of copies, has Mao with great sun rays going out from his face. And the communist song that's sung in Chinese schools at the beginning of each day likens the Communist Party to the sun. And you've got in Japan, which of course is the country of the rising sun, for years it was believed that the sun goddess, Arimatsu, had sent her great-great-great-grandchild, Jimmu, down to Japan to create peace, and he was made the first emperor. And that started off the tradition of the emperors of Japan being descendants of the sun goddess. They were themselves divine. And when the Second World War was in full fling, and you had the association of the emperor with Shintoism and through a rather tortuous route into Japanese right-wing philosophies. At the war's end, General MacArthur was sent to Japan, and he said to the then emperor, Hirohito, I want you to declare publicly that you are not a divine being. It was so important to establish that if Japan was going to obey American orders.
Hmm. Just one other thing, and we have a caller here, that, again, one of these interesting details that I picked up in the book. We, in Western sacred art, Western religious art, we're used to seeing various kinds of divine and celestial beings with halos. And that is, what that is it's a representation of the sun. And I gather that it's something we actually borrowed.
Yes. In pagan times, the halo, of course, had nothing to do with Christianity, but was simply a sign of the power of the sun over particular people. And initially, the Christian church was a bit worried about adopting halos for the use that we now associate them with, because they were worried that people would be worshipping the sun rather than the Christian God. And so it was a gradual process by which halos were seen to be regarded as a good thing. But as I say, most of the pagan solar myths and solar symbols, the Christian church scooped up and said, thank you very much.
Our guest in this hour, Richard Cohen. He is a former publishing director of Hutchinson, also Hodder and Stoughton. He's founder of Richard Cohen Books. He's the author of a book that looks at the history of sword fighting by the sword. He also has been a competitive fencer himself. He is the author of a new book that's titled Chasing the Sun, The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. Random House is the publisher and is full of stories like those that he has told about the significance of the sun, not only to human life, but also to human culture. Questions are welcome. We have another person here who's ready to talk with us, and others are welcome. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And this caller is in Spring Bay on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. The sun is shining brightly here in Spring Bay this morning. It's a beautiful day. And this is a book that sounds really interesting. I've thought about myself doing something like this because I've got into a extended reading period on the sun. And the one thing that I started to kind of come across was the idea of storytelling and personification and that connection to our imagination. And I'm just wondering if you've thought anything about the connection between our imaginative life and our narrative storytelling, which I think is a sense of divinity to be able to do that, and its connection with the sun. And I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I look forward to reading. You must continue with your book. There's so much still to say about the sun. In my book, 600 pages. I think I'd answer your point this way. You can't have such a powerful life-giving force as the sun in our lives without it inspiring us through all the arts, not just literature. So part of my book goes into the way it's inspired artists, pictorial artists through the ages, musicians, architects, as well as poets and novelists. And you go back to Homer, to Dante, to Chaucer, to Shakespeare. Pretty well all the great writers through the Western canon and beyond have either been inspired by the sun directly or in some way have written about it. The various critical commentaries on the Odyssey and the Iliad, for instance, that say that as well as being amazing works of art as poems, they are also astronomical textbooks. There's a kind of theme running through the books, which is Homer, if ever one particular person, it wasn't just a conglomerate of people. Homer is trying to argue through a description of the skies and the sun's part in the skies. So you're absolutely right. It's inspired people through the ages.
One of the things that you ran about is that the number of things that people have built, structures. They may not all be buildings, but different sorts of intentional constructions that people have made that are one way or another lined up with the sun, for the sun. They mark the fact that the sun is at certain places at certain times, and maybe one of the big things and most famous things, as an example, that people think of is Stonehenge.
Well, Stonehenge began to be built in 2900 BC, and there have been so many different theories about what it was built for, running from that it was some kind of special racetrack to a burial ground. One of the things which I think one can't dispute is it was there partly as an observatory and partly as a place of worship. And if you go there on the day of the solstice, summer solstice or winter solstice, you can see there's a great rock called the Heel Stone. Heel means sun in Welsh. And it's about 16 feet high. And you can see the solstice and the sun rise just to the left of the rock, and it's an extraordinary vision. It just takes your breath away. But there are over 3,000 structures, mainly of stone, throughout the world, which in some way are either worshipping the sun and or acting as observatories of it. And you've got the pyramids in Egypt, of course, which are, again, quite extraordinary buildings. And the pharaohs, pharaoh means great house, the pharaohs would be using them as their crypts with the idea that the main crypts would be aligned with the sun, and that the souls of the dead pharaohs would rise up through the pyramid into the heavens. So there's a lot of wishful thinking went along with the worship.
Well, we have some other callers here. Let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all on this chilly morning.
Good morning.
Maybe you can help me with this logic, and I've always wondered why it is such, and maybe you can't. When people during the Middle Ages, they believed that the Earth was flat. Obviously, the Greeks and others knew better than that, but at one time, people thought the Earth was flat. However, every day when they woke up, they could look at the sun and they could look at the moon, and they were both round. Why would you think it was flat?
I think that what we think of as the ridiculous views of past times always mystifies. How could people have felt like that? And I have to say that there's still some people in various parts of the world who still think the Earth is flat. You may ask them why they think that way. I think that you've got to realize how difficult it was to communicate ideas before the invention of the printing press.
I see.
And that many people would just look along the horizon and not think about all the evidence that shows that the Earth was spherical. But then, again, you know, here I am describing the Earth as spherical. If you went to people in the street now, I suspect, and said, is the Earth round? They would say yes. And it's not exactly round. Or rather, does it orbit the sun in a circle? They'd say yes, rather than saying that it orbits in an ellipsis. And I rather think, you know, there's a tendency to think of oneself at the end of time rather than in time. It's a natural kind of human instinct. And there are lots of ideas we have that maybe just 50 years hence will be shown to be hugely outdated.
I see. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Line number 1 is next in Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so you might have covered some of this, but I did hear you speak about the halos, and I wanted to raise a few different things in connection with that. First, that you spoke about Christian and pagan halos. I wanted to say that in the Indian subcontinent and in Asia, halos have, for instance, around the Buddha, when the Buddha is depicted, there's often a halo around various bodhisattvas and arhats and lohans. Chinese depictions or Southeast Asian depictions, there are sometimes halos of different sorts, and sometimes the auras vary in terms of colors depending upon different qualities, and there are people who supposedly can even see them, and there's places, I think, in some of the sutras where they talk about that. So that's one side. The other is, and you might have brought this up in the Hebrew Bible, you have Moses coming down from Mount Sinai with light being emitted from his head. I'll see what you have to say and if I have anything further to add to that.
No, you're absolutely right. It's very difficult to find cultures which haven't used the sun as giving leading figures a special aura. Oddly, you mentioned China. I would say that China is one of the few cultures that doesn't follow that precept. And despite what I was saying about Mao, who is certainly the iconography of the Cultural Revolution, is almost based on the sun. In ancient China, it's very hard to find any painting that even has the sun in it. And the Chinese regarded themselves, they had 5 points of the compass, north, south, east, west, and middle. China, of course, means middle.
Yes.
And they didn't see the sun, it had an importance, but they didn't give it the kind of power that you find in just about every other culture.
Well, there are pictures, and I can't be sure because I just have reproductions, and of Lohan, which is the Chinese way of depicting the arhats, the disciples of the Buddha, and sometimes they're 16 and sometimes they're 18, and often these Chinese depictions of them have some sort of halos around them. I can't vouch for historical authenticity. I think they're often Tang and Sung period, so it's 8th, 9th century, 10th century, 11th century.
You're absolutely right. I'm not saying that the sun was dismissed. I mean, you've got the sun was meant to be a representative of yin and the moon of yang properties,
yeah,
which, of course, go back even longer period than that.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with Richard Cohen about his book, Chasing the Sun, The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. Random House is the publisher. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to take a giant leap here into the present and talk a little bit about contemporary science. And one of the things I want to make sure that we talk about are sunspots. Something I'm sure people have heard of, they probably don't, and I really don't know exactly what they are, but it's a good thing, I think, probably for us to be talking about, because we are apparently going to be coming into a period here over the next couple of years where the projections are there's going to be a lot of sunspot activity, and that will indeed have an effect on life on Earth.
It's one of the most thrilling stories in science, I think, which I learned about only when I was researching the book. Sunspots, there are various records that go back almost to the earliest records that human beings kept that suggest that ancient man had seen sunspots and realized that there was something on the sun. But it wasn't until the beginning of the 17th century and the invention of the telescope that we really started to learn about them. And that's when Galileo, who passed off the telescope as his invention. It wasn't, but he managed to get away with it. Got a huge rise in his annual salary by pretending he'd invented the thing. He looked through the telescope and looked at the sun and saw these seeming blotches on its surface. And this was a terrible realization. There was this great sphere in the skies, powerful and life-giving. And it seemed to have this spatial acne. It had blemishes. And for 2 years, Galileo kept his finding secret because he was frightened he'd be persecuted for basically doing a kind of emperor's clothes on the sun, saying this great orb isn't the spotless power we imagined. But then thereafter, there was a huge amount of research. these sunspots were, these seeming great cavities that moved across the sun, normally hunting in twos, if one could put it that way. And you then have, in the 18th century, the discovery that when there was major sunspot activity, that could lead to great solar storms, and these in turn would affect the climate on Earth. And so as recently as 1978, when there was great solar storm activity, the whole of Quebec had its electrical grid destroyed, or rather put out, by these storms. And it had to, I think it cost something over $4 million to put right. So when people say that in the next 2 years we're coming up to another cycle of sunspot high activity, we may learn that, for instance, global warming is far more affected by the sun than currently is made out.
Hmm. We have someone else to talk with in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest is aware of a fascinating fact about sunspots, which is that shortly after the invention of photography, someone had the idea of taking two photographs of the sun a day or two apart, and by putting up two photographs like that as left and right sides of a stereogram, the sunspots allow you to see the sun as an actual three-dimensional sphere, which was the first time that a celestial body could be seen by the human eye directly as a three-dimensional sphere, as opposed to merely as a disk, which is, of course, how you see the moon or the sun ordinarily. You don't really see it as a sphere, but rather as a disk, and you assume it's a sphere. But by using the rotation of the sun, which has a rotation period of 25 days, and the pattern of sunspots on it, you can actually see it in, you know, as a solid sphere.
No, that's very interesting. It's interesting also that some things we learn astronomically are built on what we learn from the sun at the moment of eclipse, that we can discover things about the corona of the sun only when the sun is put out, which is another thing we learn from the use of photography. But I was lucky enough to go to the Pope's summer residence, Castel Gandolfo, about half an hour's train run from the center of Rome. And that's also used as an observatory. And I actually was allowed to read Galileo's own book and his drawings of sunspots. And you can see, I mean, he's a brilliant draftsman as well as everything else. And you can see, even from his drawings, the shapes which sunspots took.
Just about 5 minutes or so, so many things that we could talk about. One other thing I just wanted to get to a little bit was maybe you could talk a little bit about the history of the interest in solar energy. Certainly now people are interested in green renewable sources of energy, and one of the things that's certainly true is that the sun pours a lot of energy over the Earth that we could theoretically harness but don't. How far back does the interest in solar design, either in houses or in trying to use the sun as an energy source in other sorts of ways, how far back does that go?
Well, a long, long way. I'll begin by saying I was reading the second volume of Michael Caine's autobiography the other day, which has just come out, and he talks about a lunch he had with his mother and with David Hockney and his mother, the four of them. And David Hockney's mother, coming from north of England, said, "Oh, it's a terrible shame. It's such a waste." And they were having lunch out in California, and the other three at the lunch said, "Well, what do you mean, a terrible waste?" And she said, "Look at this wonderful sun, and nobody's got their washing hanging out." And she was really saying, or having the same realization that people have had through the centuries, that there's this amazing energy and heat source that is being underused. Now, to begin with, people would use it as a possible weapon. You've got the story, which I think is made up, but it still shows the way people were thinking, of Archimedes setting fire to the Roman fleet by directing the sun's power by using mirrors and shining it onto the Roman boats. It took some while. Actually, Leonardo da Vinci was to the forefront of this, to suggest that the sun could be harnessed for peaceful means. His idea was to use glass mirrors, and he actually suggested making a mirror that would have been larger than all the glass then available throughout the civilized world. So it didn't come to anything. But he had the idea that perhaps one could reflect the sun's light and the sun's heat and use it for peaceful means. And as that idea continued, one of the problems was that other energy sources, their proponents, people who ran oil fields or coal or whatever, had very powerful public relations, and they used to damn the idea of using the sun's energy in any practical way. So you get throughout the last century and the last half of the 19th century, you get the idea of solar energy coming in and out of fashion. And you might get solar panels being used in Florida or California to a small degree. But it's really only in the last 40 years or so that the idea has taken off to anything like an appreciable extent. And even now, our energy needs are fed by the sun to about just over 2%.
And what do people think reasonably that it could be? I know that there are people who talk about just how much it can do, and maybe other people that say the most we could ever hope for would be maybe about 20%. What does anybody really think is realistic?
Well, the amount of sunshine that the world has on it in 44 minutes is enough to meet the world's energy needs for a year. So, almost literally the sky's the limit. And it's a matter of willpower and organization. The cost of solar panels is going down and down, but one of the problems is in many countries solar energy has been subsidized by government funding, and therefore other, whether it's nuclear energy or various other forms of energy production, their proponents are saying solar energy just doesn't make sense financially. But, you know, supposing you were to say, well, the Mojave Desert in California could easily be used as a major solar energy area, and there was a will to make it so, then your figure of 20% might be on the conservative side. Sadly, though, I think we're looking well to the future before the political will is there.
You know, there's only so much one could put in the book, and this is something I don't think that you get into in the book, but I was just curious whether you had thought about or had talked with any of the scientists who are doing work on the possibility of developing fusion, nuclear fusion, which is the force that powers the sun, as an energy generation technology here that we could use.
I did fusion in a bottle and all of that, but I felt that the sun, as I discovered, gets into everything, but I wanted people to be able to carry the book around for it to be a friendly, something they wouldn't swear at. So maybe it's a book you can take to bed with you, feeling everything you want to know about the sun is there, and it will require another book to go into some of the byways that solar energy leads to.
Well, are there people who think that that's something that it's possible actually to think about? Certainly there are many technical challenges. Is that something that there are people who say yes, maybe within, who knows, 10 years, 15, 20 years?
There's a great deal of research going on about that, but it's yet to be successful.
Well, just as a way of maybe to finish up, you talked about how the fact that you had this idea that maybe you'd like to begin the book with a sunrise and finish with a sunset. And you talked a little bit about seeing the sunrise on Mount Fuji. You also went to see the sunset in India at the Ganges.
I did. I mean, there are many beautiful sunsets in the world. I thought perhaps going to watch the sun go down in California, which is famous for them, would be what I would choose. But one of the things, I didn't intend this as a theme for the book, but it became one, was the way in which we take the sun for granted. You know, we know the sun, for instance, causes terrible skin cancer, so yet we still bask underneath it as if it doesn't have the power that we know that it has. And I decided that I would go to India, because India, in a way, has, along with its, I think, in many ways, crazy myths, it also has a kind of reverence for the sun, and maybe an understanding of it that we could learn from. And Varanasi, which is one of their great holy cities, is evidence of this. And so I took a small skiff along the Ganges, both watching the dawn rituals and, as you said, the sunset rituals. And it, I think, did give me a reverence for the sun. I do think writing this book and researching it has changed the way I look at the sun and my understanding of it.
Mm. Well, there, I think that we'll have to finish up. There is much, much more here in the book that we have not talked about, a lot more about the sun in human culture, also a section that takes a look at artists and the way that they have thought about the sun. And, of course, that's the manipulation of light in painting certainly is a very important and interesting subject. So lots, lots more in the book. It's titled Chasing the Sun. The subtitle is The Epic Story of the Star That Gives Us Life. It's published by Random House by our guest, Richard Cohen. And Mr. Cohen, thank you very much for giving us some time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.